Welcome to the Farm CPA Podcast with Top Producer. I'm your host, Paul Niefer. In today's podcast, we are joined by Jim Wiesmeyer of Pro Farmer. I have known Jim for many years, and if I need to know what is going on in Washington, D.C., Jim is the first person I reach out to. And Jim will probably likely say that I might be the first person that he reaches out to on farm tax updates. I think you will enjoy our conversation, and let's get started. I am happy to be joined today by Jim Wiesmeyer. Now, you told me offline that you were in Arizona warming up, but where are you at right now, Jim?
Well, I'm in, you know, Virginia, just outside of D.C., but, you know, it wasn't really warm in Tucson, Arizona, when I was there earlier this week, although warmer than D.C. area, but, you know, they had that cold front as well, but then it warmed up later this week.
Actually, yesterday afternoon here where I'm at, which is southeastern Washington State, we actually hit 70. So it was a pretty nice day. But we're supposed to be back, I think, a high of 45 or so today, which is typical March weather. You know, one day it's 80 or 75 and the next day it's 40. So
absolutely.
Jim, we're just going to have a discussion on various topics. Again, this is sort of a new podcast that I've started in conjunction with Top Producer, as far as, you know, I write a column called Farm CPA, and obviously you and I have had multiple discussions throughout the years. And so today it'll just be a conversation about various topics that I think are timely right now.
Sure. Absolutely.
I think the first one, and you may not know that much about this, but I think you'll have some ideas. And that's on the Biden tax plan. I know that, you know, during the campaign, and we know that the progressive side of the Democratic Party, or maybe all the Democratic Party, definitely want to raise taxes. And I think what's probably most important for farmers to realize is that the estate side of it, whether they roll back the lifetime exclusion, whether they eliminate the step up in basis at death, or the one I'm probably more worried about, the Canadian system where there's a capital gains tax at death. What are you hearing right now? Is this something that's becoming more front of burner, or what do you hear right now, Jim?
Absolutely, Paul. In fact, it looks like Biden and his people and the top Democrats in Congress are wanting to expedite this. Just a few weeks ago, we thought this was later rather than sooner, because Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, who used to be the Federal Reserve Chairwoman, wanted to wait to see how the U.S. economy was going. But I think that they really want to, they're going pell-mell on this, Paul. The reason, they'll never say this publicly, the reason is that they think in 2 years, after the 2022 elections, they may lose control of the House. So that's why you're seeing a very rapid movement by Biden and his team to have their must-pass bills. And tax reform is one of them, Paul.
Is there a sort of any consensus yet whether it would be retroactive to 2021, or would it likely take effect in 2022, or still too soon to know?
High odds it would not start until 2022. So I think, this calendar year, it would not impact. And that's really based on history, too. They usually don't go retroactive on a tax bill. And, I wouldn't even rule out some of these provisions taking effect even later because of those upcoming elections. But again, bottom line, I don't highly expect that this will not impact, this calendar year taxes.
And, he tends to tout the fact that those earning less than $400,000 are going to see either no tax increase or a reduction in taxes. Have you heard anything on that? I think what I'm guessing is maybe the fact that they've increased the child tax credit to $3,000 plus an extra $600 if you've got kids under age six, maybe they want to make that permanent, and they'll tout that as a tax decrease, and maybe the child care credit. Any chatter that you're hearing on that?
Well, you hear it from the different parties. Now, Biden has said this week again, if you make under $400,000, your taxes will not be increased one penny. And that's a direct quote. Now, that's going to be tested for sure with some analysis. Now, some Republicans say, which program is he talking about? Because some middle class incomers could be impacted by some of these other provisions, such as the capital gains, et cetera. We're going to have to see the income test on an expected boost in the capital gains, Paul. So that's a little more murky, but I will tell you, this will pass the House. They'll do it under budget reconciliation, which means in the Senate, you just need 50 plus one. The vice president in this case, Kamala Harris, would break the tie. But the key there is at least the two moderate, Democrats in the Senate from West Virginia and Arizona. They're going to be very careful of what they sign off on if the Republicans do not get a chance to amend this coming bill. So it's not going to go as smooth as some of the Democrats, may think, Paul. And that's Joe Manchin from West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona to watch out for.
Now, is that Vice President Harris or is that President Harris?
that's Vice President Harris right now. But I will tell you, in my speaking circuit, that's always a question I get, is what's the possibility there? And that gets into murky area. But I will tell you, if a horrible situation would result in the case of, President Biden, for whatever reason, Kamala Harris was labeled the most liberal Democrat in the Senate by a usually very bipartisan Congressional Publishing Group last year, the Congressional Quarterly, roll call. So that's why you get all these questions, when you go out to speak.
Yeah, no, it's going to be interesting. I mean, if Biden makes it all the way through, with all of his faculties, and just makes it through, he'll be, 82 or almost 83 when he finally gets through the first term. So
like to say, Paul, on Biden is his first day as president, he was older than President Reagan was his last day in office. And, my line has always been, all great men are dead and I don't feel well myself. You tend to lose a step or two. And that's really, I think, what we're seeing. I'm in no way to judge his faculties, but it's obvious he's not the old Joe that I first covered as a beat reporter when I first got to town in the 1970s.
Yeah. Well, and we know what happened to Reagan the last, two or three years of the office. It obviously wasn't him running the country. And of course, we've had that throughout history. We had Woodrow Wilson the last year or two had a stroke, and in the country never really knew about it until long afterwards. So, it is what it is. Now, over on a universal income plan, where they're starting to make, this child tax credit, they're going to pay that out in a monthly type stipend. Is that the first initial stage where the progressives hopefully will get their $1,000 per month or whatever it might be? Is that where we're headed?
Well, that's the first step. You're absolutely correct. And I always like to put in, this explanation of the term progressives. That really means far left lawmakers. Okay, that's a creative term the Democrats picked up when they saw that the use of the term far left was really hurting them in elections. But this is the far left push. The Bernie Sanders, the Elizabeth Warren group, AOC, et cetera. But no doubt, this is the Democrats have always wanted, minimum income guarantee. And I think this is step one, Paul.
Yeah. I notice AOC isn't down at the border anymore having any sound bites. I am noticing that. So
it's a challenge. It's a challenge.
Yeah. Yeah. Over on carbon credits, you know, we keep hearing that this might be a benefit to farmers. This might be another income source for farmers. I think right now what I've heard and maybe you've read, it's a little soon to really know exactly what it does mean for farmers, and probably the people that get in first might be harmed by getting in first. Are you hearing anything on what that might mean for our farm audience out there?
Well, you know, several things. I think this is going to take far longer than most realize right now. Even Secretary Vilsack has said this thing in the final process could take several administrations. So I think he's you know, quite honest in that regard. Two is, usually, I know a farm program, this is far different than a basic farm, you know, safety net program. Usually the first year is the best year to come in. But there's a lot of doubts about this on this one, primarily, Paul, because even more than the tax reform, you know, debate that we talked about, there are even more loose ends on the climate change policy debate. What I'm sensing is that there'll be a lot more hearings, which there should be. We don't even know how to measure carbon at this particular time. At least there's no consensus on it. And how to price carbon. There's been some proposals, et cetera, but if they're going to base this on scientific evidence, there's a lot of conjecture regarding those topics. Farmers and ranchers I've talked to agree on one thing. They want this thing to be voluntary rather than mandatory. They hope that it will be the next revenue stream for, you know, for them, other than the free marketplace and some, you know, government, you know, program payouts. But a lot remains to be decided, Paul.
You know, out in my area, we have lots of farm operations that have gotten an enhanced revenue stream from wind power. I mean, I know we go to certain other states, you know, Texas and Oklahoma and so on. There's been quite a bit of that. We're starting to see, even in our area, a lot of solar that will be coming in, and that's a revenue stream. And a lot of this ground is not what I call very productive farmland. I mean, it's typically up high. The productive ground is down lower, but then we have people that certainly don't want it around because they think it's not aesthetically pleasing and so on. So we'll see what happens. Same with carbon credits. It's going to take time, and who knows what the end result will be.
Yeah, I will tell you that, you know, President Biden and the people I talked with at the White House signal April 22nd, which is Earth Day. They're gearing up for some type of a big climate change announcement. And in fact, the Chinese want perhaps a meeting between Biden and their president, Xi Jinping, on that day with a climate change tone concept. But Biden and Vilsack are signaling that agriculture could be one of the initial early winners in this debate. But again, they don't really say how at this particular time. What they could announce as soon as April 22nd is beyond my knowledge at the particular time. But I will tell the top producer audience that I think the initial opportunities on this topic would be pilot projects in certain states. Watch those, because those can be tested. And that's where you could see some early gains in the ag sector on some pilot projects.
Do you have any idea what those states might be? Is it too soon to even have a guess on that?
Too soon to have a guess, but if the Democrats are going to go as they've unfolded so far, it'll be Democrat-oriented states to be political here. It's just common sense that they'll pick their favorite states.
Especially if there's a, you know, a tight race coming up in 2022. So
absolutely. That's the signal that I'm getting here. But watch those pilot projects, because if you really look back at the Conservation Reserve Program, you can make the case that that really started as a pilot project. So you can see how these things are important, Paul.
Yeah. And then we know in just the last week or so, there's been a little bit of discussion. I think you've written about sort of what we call the backdoor climate change by all these state attorney generals and so on. Fill us in a little bit on that.
Well, the Wall Street Journal had an excellent commentary, editorial, if you will, on this. And, you know, I have found in the Wall Street Journal, even their commentary items are breaking news sometimes. And this is a strategy that I think this smart White House is beginning to use, because they know Washington lawmakers in Washington state, U.S. Capitol lawmakers, are going to be very antsy regarding this topic. So the backdoor approach is through the regulatory process at the state level, and that's really a part of their strategy, which I think is smart from their perspective, you know, Paul, that they can come up with state mandates, hopefully not unfunded mandates, but we've been through this process before. But that's the backdoor approach. I have never seen an issue in my over 40 years in town here where there's been a whole of government approach to a topic, and that's climate change. It runs from EPA, Energy Department, the Treasury Department, even the Federal Reserve. Every cabinet secretary, when they were introduced, mentioned climate change, Paul.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you speak of sort of a backdoor approach. I'm just in the farm sector. I was having a discussion a couple of days ago with a hog farmer of mine, and you know, California a few years past, I think it was Prop 12, or I can't remember if that was what it was, on the eggs. You know, you had to have cage-free eggs. Well, now they sort of want cage-free meat, and it's affecting my clients that raise hogs, because their end user that's getting the hogs from them is then selling into California, and they're mandating that you have to have, you know, larger facility, more room for the hogs. So it is sort of a one state mandating almost at the federal level. So, you know, it probably is one of those things where it may work, you know.
Yeah. It's just, well, we get into interstate commerce issues there, because, and usually the courts rule against these albatross state regulations. If the state wants to do it just for the state, that's fine. But it cannot cross you know, state boundaries. And that's what it usually boils down to. But it takes years to go through the courts on that.
Well, and even if it is strictly a state thing, California is such a large state for a lot of these vendors that they're just simply saying, if you want to be a customer of ours, you need to, or a vendor of ours, you're going to need to comply, because we don't want to have one rule for California, one rule for everybody else. So, you know, even though it might meet the fact that California says, hey, this only applies to us, you know, these vendors are saying, well, it's going to apply to everybody. So we'll see what happens.
This is why you saw, in essence, part of the dairy industry move from California into Colorado.
Yeah, yeah. You're listening to the Farm CPA Podcast. We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor.
Get timely updates about taxation, accounting, succession planning, and other issues that are unique to farmers and agribusiness processors. Find out about major agribusiness events and how to comply with new laws that affect your business. Subscribe to Farm CPA at blogs.claconnect.com/agribusiness and experience the CLA promise. blogs.claconnect.com/agribusiness.
Welcome back to the Farm CPA Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Niefer. Let's pick up with our conversation. I am happy to be joined today by Jim Wiesmeyer. Now, here's another subject that's maybe a little sensitive. We'll have a quick discussion on it. I almost hesitated to bring it up, but I think it is something that's important. you know, at the USDA, we have this this push to provide, I'm going to call it equity for people of color, farmers that have been disadvantaged for multiple generations. And then we had Vilsack come out and say, you know, the fact that farm program payments have been based on production, that by default, that might not be equity, I guess. Maybe I'm saying it incorrect, but fill us in a little bit on what's going on there. And where do you think that might be going?
Okay. Yeah, it is a sensitive nature as everything else. Words are really being defined in different ways now, Paul. When I began my speech in Arizona, I said, you know, I really wanted to say I was privileged to talk to the group, but even that word privileged is taking on a different connotation, if you hear me. Yeah. On the word equity, that used to be equality. But now they've shifted, by they, I mean the Biden administration and many Democrats have shifted to the term equity, not equality. The reason is redistribution. There are certain groups that are favored. You mentioned, farmers of color, but and that's Vilsack's phrase, not ours. What I like to point out that certain lawmakers are saying on the Republican side, it's just not farmers of color, it's selected farmers of color by ethnic group. If mm-hmm. you're a female farmer, you don't qualify for this at least $4 billion in payments and then another $1 billion in technical assistance, Paul. I'm not taking any judgment as far as whether it's needed or not needed. The case could be made that it is needed. However, to selectively, say certain groups get it, there could be a constitutional problem there or a reverse discrimination, test that I fully expect coming up. The average payout under this potential program, based on the Congressional Budget Office, CBO, which is supposed to be nonpartisan, is $222,000. Yeah. And some black farmer groups have said that's a drop in the bucket. So this is a sensitive issue. And now when you have USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack saying his equity commission, and we're going to have to see who's going to be part of that equity commission because personnel is the policy. That's going to be important to see which programs they look at, not just farm programs, but the whole of USDA, Vilsack says. But that would be a fundamental shift when you go outside of the production rule versus some other measurement. When Vilsack first came into the Obama administration, he was there for 8 years. His first of his 8 years, he really focused, Paul, on the 20% of farmers who produce, 80% of farmers who produce only 20% of the production. Then he got pushback, and then he reverted to look at the 20% of farmers who produce 80% of the production. I really think he's refocused back to where he really wanted to do in the early days of the Obama administration, and that's what we're seeing. It's really a redistribution of benefits.
Well, and we know that at least for this year and through part of next year, he's got the support. You know, he's got full support for that. So
he does.
It'll be interesting. I don't know what the next farm bill is going to look like. If there really is a next farm bill, we'll see what happens. But speaking of a farm bill, you hearing any chatter on crop insurance subsidies? We know both the Obama and even the Trump administration had proposed cutting subsidies for farmers, having some type of income means test and so on. Hearing any chatter on that right now?
Well, on my podcast last Friday, I had Farmer House Ag Committee Chairman Colin Peterson from, Minnesota on. He has joined as a working partner with Combest Cell, consulting group. And he said the line on crop insurance, the thing that should save them, it they have a mandate that it has to be actuarially sound. So if you go into, which some lawmakers want, especially those far left crowd, if they try to go in with a means test or a payment limit on crop insurance, you lose liquidity because then you don't get the big producers in, yep. and you need those producers. So I think that it will be attempted, but I think the evidence is clear that stay out of crop insurance, because if all the farm programs I've seen in my many decades here, is that's one of the best risk management tools and revenue assurance tools that I've ever seen.
Yeah, I think the law of unintended consequences, if you, like you say, if you get rid of those, let's say, higher income, more progressive, more efficient farmers that probably typically don't get crop insurance claims, you know, they still participate because it is a way of guaranteeing revenue, but they really don't need it. Then what you're going to see happen is everybody else, their premiums are going to, instead of going up by 5%, they're going to go up by 50 or 100 or 200%. And you're going to see it collapse, basically. So
absolutely. How I have seen that naysayer lawmakers who want to attack the crop insurance program, when you show them some of the huge checks that farmers and ranchers write themselves with skin in the game in crop insurance, they have no idea how much skin in the game farmers and ranchers have in crop insurance. And also the crop insurance, the best way to sell crop insurance is to call it you know food safety insurance, yeah. you yeah. know, so, and then you can cast away a lot of diversions, but it's low hanging fruit, Paul. Eventually when this town, it'll be later rather than sooner, worries about our tremendous debt, they're going to focus on the lower hanging fruit, and the crop insurance program is one of them.
Yep. And then I think the last topic I had, unless you had a couple other topics that you wanted to discuss with me, is, you know, I keep getting calls from farmers. I had one yesterday. When are we going to get the $20 per acre payment that was promised in the, CAA that was passed at the end of the year? You know, we've heard nothing. I mean, we know Vilsack and the administration has delayed the other $1 billion for the hog and some of the specialty crop producers, the contract growers and so on. Any chatter on, is that coming later this month? Is it April? Is it May? Is it never? What are you hearing?
Some updates. First, we have remember in the waning days of the Trump administration, they announced up to $2.3 billion in additional aid. Now they're calling that CFAP-AA, additional aid, CFAP additional aid. Vilsack, in an interview with AgriTalk last week, kind of mentioned that $2.3 billion could go up to around $3 billion. So I think they have found some even more funding, Paul. I do think that they're reviewing that program more than what we call CFAP-3. That was the $13 billion in you know program payouts relative to what Congress passed December 21. Now, here's the update. On the AA, the additional aid, it looks like they found more funding. I think based on Vilsack's comments, at least the signals that he's given, they're looking at that over 90% of those payouts were going to go to contract, you know, producers, you know, primarily poultry, but some hog contract producers. I think that they're reviewing that, and they could offer additional payments to farmers and ranchers who did not get anything under CFAP 1, 2, or 3. I mean, that's what he says. Now, CFAP 3, where the big kahuna payments, $20 per acre. Now, that is a prescriptive language in the bill. I don't think they can alter that. Even though, you know, lawyers can do wonders in this town, but I think that's pretty locked in. Vilsack early on said CFAP 3 payments would probably be unpaused at the end of March or early April. So that's the time frame I'm getting, Paul.
Okay. And that's what I've told my clients that call me, and I said, hey, it's in the law. It should be coming. It's probably March, April, May, somewhere in there. You know, they got to get through this other stuff. And of course, even in the bill, like you said, hey, it's written right in there. Thou shalt get $20 per acre, but it doesn't say when you're going to get the $20 per acre. So, that's what everybody's been counting on. Anything else that you wanted to cover today that we haven't covered already?
Well, this one, I can kind of tie the knots here on one that you learn many things over 40 years, but in how much a program is allocated, a farmer rancher should always wonder whether or not the language in a bill says are not such sums as necessary. That's a wide open program. That's not the case with the CFAP 3. It's very prescriptive on the formula and the amount of money. And the around $3 billion, it looks like, for the CFAP-AA program. But in the case of the selected farmers of color, it's such sums as necessary. Well, now that's interesting. So this is just an estimate of $4 billion. It could be considerably higher than that. So I do like to point that out on that one. And the only other topic I want to bring up, because wherever I go, either on virtual, speeches, Paul, or on site now, USDA's estimates and the World Board forecast come up, and with the question, what in the heck is going on at USDA? And so I think you're going to see, hopefully, a significant review of the procedures and the additional aid that the USDA's NAS, it looks like they need to improve their estimates, not only for crop production, grains, soybeans, grain stocks, cotton production. They were awful the last year on the way late, and from the World Board, their forecast on demand, they were well behind the curve on knowing the amount of imports that corn imports that China was going to have. So from, I know the top producer audience would want me to address that, and the answers are still not there yet, but something is amiss at USDA and it needs to be looked at.
Yeah, I think they've gotten in such a habit of smoothing, estimates instead of just coming up with the correct estimate. They want to sort of smooth it out, which sometimes is positive. We had a report, a couple months ago or a month ago that was positive for crops. And then other times, because of their delay, it's negative. So I think you're right. They, it's just like the IRS. I think we all agree right now, IRS probably needs more funding because they still haven't processed, 100,000, 200,000 of tax returns from 2019. So, whether you agree with the IRS, it is an essential part of the government to collect money. So,
it's not as bad as the U.S. Postal Service. I don't know whether it's like that out there where you live, but it is really god awful up here. It's weeks late in getting simple mail. I mean, I have a letter coming from DC that was mailed last Thursday and I still don't have it.
Yeah. I had a client of mine call me or send me an email a few days ago. She had mailed her tax stuff to me to, prepare. They live in Ohio. I'm out here in Washington State. They had mailed it on, if my memory's right, February 16th, and it showed up on March 16th. So it took exactly a month for the mail to get here. So, it's bad right now. So,
from a market perspective, I want to add one thing. I worked many years ago with a very good commodity analyst, Jim Wyckoff, when he worked for then Oster Communications, which I did. He put out a report today that grain traders need to keep an eye on crude oil prices because the huge price decline this week, he said, was a shot across the bow for raw commodity market bulls. And if oil prices would take out yesterday's low, and I haven't looked at the prices, they were kind of shaky this morning. He said that would be one clue that many of the raw commodity sector markets that have been in rally modes may have topped out, at least for the near term, including the grains. So these smart people I tend to listen to. So that's just more of a cautionary stance.
Well, and we remember a bull market needs good news all the time. And lately, we really have had a lack of good news. We haven't had bad news necessarily, but we've had a lack of good news. So I think, And, you know, all markets have pauses, and perhaps that's what we're seeing right now. And farmers do have ability right now to lock in some good prices. So,
absolutely.
You know, that's something they need to be cognizant of. So again, yes. Jim, thank you very much. This is a top producer farm CPA podcast. We're still, you know, trying to figure out the format and everything, but certainly I will love to maybe do this on a monthly or a quarterly basis with you.
Anytime, Paul. You give a lot to the ag sector. I know I read everything that you put out, and I'm here to help you at any time.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Jim.
Sure. Okay.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast. I'm Paul Niefer, and we'll be back next week with a new episode of the Farm CPA podcast with Top Producer.